And welcome to Tiny Voice Talks with me, Tori Bono. And today, Tiny Voice is talking about changing perceptions and deciphering the language of behavior. Yes, we are indeed. We're talking about behavior again, people, because it is such a complex issue. And I'm joined today by Graham Chatley, who has come to share his expertise with us. So welcome, Graham.
Hello.
It's great to have you here. It really is.
It's lovely to be here.
So for anyone that hasn't come across you yet, Graham, who is Graham Chatley?
Graham Chatley is a primary school teacher, started off in year four, wasn't very good at that. I'll talk about why in a bit. I moved to secondary and taught PE in secondary for a few years. And then I kind of stumbled into what was then Boys EBD or Naughty Boys, as they were known at the time, which then became social emotional behavioural difficulties, and we had to understand why those children weren't able to coexist very well and were avoiding group work and getting into fights and things along those lines. And then we got girls and it became very interesting all of a sudden as five girls came in and 60 boys got a lot quieter. And then it was the time to move to social emotional mental health. And we had to move away from that sort of traditional, maybe even a little bit behaviorist in nature, if you like, to more understanding of why those children were behaving in that way. So since I started there, I took over as a pastoral lead and assistant head. I did a lot of outreach work with mainstream schools and trying to keep children who were at risk of exclusion in schools and how we could support them and things along those lines. And I left that at the best time ever, Christmas 2019, 3 months before the apocalypse, to set up on my own, which left me with a nice quiet time. But now I go around and I do lots of training, various different types of training, whether that's trauma-informed or behaviour-related, de-escalation, things like that. I do some consultancy within the schools, whether that's individual pupil or whole school structure, etc., culture, and anything people pay me for, really.
Nice. I like that. And so I'm interested when you said about it was the time to move away from, was there a point then where that there was sort of a change?
Yeah, I think for me it was leadership within the school. And a change of approach from what had been very sort of trauma informed to more traditional approach, bringing in sort of stricter uniform policies and things like that. And it wasn't really working, and it wasn't really working for me. And I felt like it was time for a change. Now it was kind of a, do I take a sideward step or do I take a leap of faith? And I took the leap of faith, just my timing was just terrible. But in a way, had I not took it at the time I did, and had we not had COVID, there wouldn't be a book that we'd be talking about today because I wouldn't have time to write it. So although it was challenging for the time, some of the things that came out of the time, you know, the people I've met and spoken to and networks and finding out that actually there's a real need for this, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's actually worked out really well in the end. It's just been a slightly hairy time, really. And I don't think it could be a better time for it.
No. What I noticed is that there is so much out there now about behaviour and trauma-informed, but there's also a lot of talk on the likes of Twitter about how behaviour should be done. And you have those traditionalist routes that you've discussed, which is, you know, the uniform must be so and so, and people must walk in silence around the corridors and everything. And then you've got the other side, but it doesn't feel polarized, but it seems on Twitter especially that it is sort of one or the other. But your book goes a lot more into the depth of behavior.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that we are in a bit of a fork in the road situation. So certainly at secondary, where we've got that traditional you know, up to zero tolerance is at the extreme end, but are very much, you know, we're starting to, you know, because after COVID, what has always been probably 5% of children that struggle is now 10, 15, 20%. Yeah. And we'll talk about why that is as we go through. So schools are struggling, and I think potentially school leaders and teachers are feeling a bit out of control. And so what's the answer when you're starting to feel out of control? And for some, it's exerting more external control and clamping down and, you know, hitting hard on the rules, which again is what's probably what is coming from the DfE and things like that. And so schools get take that approach, but we've got so many children out of school at the moment, it's very, very worrying. And then there are others that are very trauma-informed and supportive of young people and talking about understanding and all those things, which I totally support, but it seems to be one or the other. And actually, we've got most people are somewhere in between. I think most people are near the fence. They're possibly into schools off the back of initial teacher training that is more down a behaviourist line and things along those lines. And they've been asked to be very hard and very, very, you know, behaviourist, traditional, whatever you want to describe it as, but it doesn't really work for them. And so they're probably looking for something different, but they don't know what there is. And the whole point of this book was to take those people, and I was one of them when I started my career, and actually, could I move them onto one side of the fence where we have a bit more understanding of these young people? And by supporting that, those 5-10% of young people that are struggling, will that benefit everybody? And I believe it can. And that's what this is all about.
Yeah. And you start the introduction of your book with, I started my teaching career completely unprepared. The messages I'd taken led me to try to be an authority figure, but I lacked the personality. And I completely related to that, because that's what I was taught whenever I was, you know, had my first class. Go in, don't smile at them for the first term. Make sure they know you're not their friend. You are not their friend. But, and had that repeated and underlined and double underlined. And yet it's very difficult, I think, to get away from that sort of behaviourist approach as such, because I still see that from people that are trained today coming in with that behaviourist approach where they've been told by someone, clearly very long in the tooth, not to smile at the children till Christmas.
Yeah, I only 5 years ago I was working with the university, and that was the last piece of advice that was given to the outgoing. It's just a terrible, terrible piece of advice. And I remember my class hadn't been very, very good in the ICT room, and I brought them back, and I was sort of struck, and so I did this big shouty performance with them, you know, and it was all fake, and it was, you know, because I thought that was what you needed to do, and it just didn't connect at all, and it wasn't me, and I wasn't happy, I wasn't enjoying it, I didn't want to be a teacher anymore. I thought it was me, and I thought it was me not being very good at it. And I'd made the decision that was me done less than a year in. And the thing was, I made that decision less than a year in, and I was comfortable with it. I was going to go and do something else, and I relaxed. And when I relaxed, things started to change. And then it was at one of those times, you know, the wonderful times, you know, early 2000s, where if you ran a club, you got extra money.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, I'm going to be unemployed soon, so let's get some money in the bank. So I started doing three clubs. I did a football, a rugby, and a chess club. Mm-hmm. And in those clubs, it was fun. It was no pressure. And I started to connect with the children in a different way. And then all of a sudden in my lesson, the way those children were behaving in my lessons was completely different. And it took too long for the penny to drop. I fully admit that. But it was, you're trying to reorganize everything you've been told, because it's actually set you up to fail. And
Yeah.
That the whole point of this book was to write something that I wish I'd had when I started out, because so people don't make the same mistakes I did.
Yeah. And your first chapter is how important relationships are. And I love the quote you chose, relationships are the agents of change, and the most powerful therapy is human love.
Yeah.
You know, it seems that that's the foundation of your book very much, the fact that really all relationships that we have are so vital for that changing perceptions.
It was something I mean, and that's a Bruce Perry quote, and you know, Bruce Perry was sent me down a rabbit hole I've never got out of, and all. but I had the pleasure of interviewing Kim Golding when I did my radio show, and you know, she calls it the two hands of parenting. Mm. And I know it's been known as the two hands of discipline, but it's that balance between relationships and boundaries. And, yeah. You know, a lot of the time what happens when you're talking about relationships is that means you are making excuses for the behavior. Mm-hmm. And it's explanations rather than excuses. But if you're focused on relationships, you're their friend and you're not having any boundaries and you don't have any expectations, and you don't have any rules. And it's simply not true. It's all about balancing the two. But the flip side of that, you know, it's something Mark Finnis talks about with his four ways and things like that. If you are doing two children and if you are just having all these rules and these expectations without any relationship foundations, it's just going to cause resentment and disconnection, especially if you're working with teenagers. You know, you've got to connect at some level with them before you start throwing boundaries and rules and stuff into place. You know, I often say to schools, because I do work with young people with additional needs and things like that, and pathological demand avoidance is absolutely fantastic. If you can work with that, you can work with anything. But it's kind of, if we treated every young person as if they were PDA, and I know that's a label that's probably going to change very soon and stuff, and like labels do, but if we treated every child like they were pathological demand avoidance, then you stop ordering children around, you start communicating with them, you explain yourself to them, you ask them to do things. What's so bad about that? Why do we feel the need that we've got to order children around and be really firm with them and be really harsh with them and stuff? Because that's so that we feel more powerful and we have that authority. 90% of children will do what we want because they are the child, but they're the adult, because they've had solid foundations, safe parenting experiences, etc. For others, it doesn't work like that. And we've got to tweak how we work and how we communicate with these young people.
Mm. Now, earlier you said that more children than ever are now struggling. Why?
I think it's a combination, and it's not just COVID. I think COVID certainly is a factor, but COVID is the final wave of a perfect storm that's come for these young people. It's been happening over a period of time where parents are becoming more and more isolated, and that's partly due to geography. It's partly due to possibly more single parents. Certainly got a lot to do with social media and the media itself. You know, parents are being shamed a lot. You know, whether it's somebody putting up photos of the perfect family on Facebook or something like that, which is totally fake, as we all know, but some people don't know, and they think that's what they've got to try and do. And my family isn't like that, so I'm not good enough, etc. Then you've got social mobility commissioners and things like that it's all on the parent, it's all the pressure. And so if you're in that position, then you tend to insulate yourself and hide yourself away. Then you've got some parents who are absolutely screaming from the rooftops for help, but CAMS, Sure Start, Home Start, you just can't get support from anywhere because of the situation that we're in. So you're either don't want to ask or you can't get. What do you do in that situation? You're home, you're struggling, you don't feel good enough, all of those different things. Well, I just need 5 minutes. I just need to keep them out of trouble. I need to keep them occupied. let's give them a phone, let's give them an iPad, let's sit them in front of a screen, and all of those things, those things do the occupying, do the parenting to a degree for some of those young people. But what we're missing is important interactions. We're missing milestones. We're missing communication. We're missing, we're getting instant gratification and things like that, which are not helpful for certainly very young developing brains. Mm-hmm. And so you put all those things together, it's not a great position to be in. And then you throw COVID on top. And what would have happened when those parents were struggling is that other adults would have come in and offered a different adult, different support, different role models, and, you know, picked up some of the slack and the whole it's a village that raises a child and all that kind of stuff. Because of COVID, that was stopped. So you weren't having the grandparents coming in. You weren't having uncles and aunties and friends. So when you put all of those pieces together, that for me is why a lot of children are struggling. And the narrative that's driving me around the bend at the moment is the resilience narrative that you keep hearing from up above. You know, children are just resilient, they'll bounce back and they'll do all these different things. Children that have got solid foundations and have actually had, you know, positive adult experiences during the lockdowns and things like that, those young people will bounce back because they've got those solid foundations. For children that haven't got those solid foundations, the gap's just got bigger. And they haven't got that ability to bounce back because they haven't got that safety and that trust and that belonging that they need in order to do that. So that for me is why that gap's getting bigger, why I think we need to focus everything on safety, trust and belonging for these young people to help them to get back to where we want them to be.
Yeah. Having taught before, during and after COVID, it is distinctly different in our classrooms.
I mean, if you take the youngest members of our school community, and I know there'll be secondary teachers and educators listening to this, but it's very relevant if we take it back to the beginning. So you've got a young person that start of their life has been, you know, never been told no, never been asked to wait, never had to share a parent's attention. And then they walk into a nursery or reception,
yeah,
and they're confused by the whole situation. They're mm-hmm. frustrated at being asked to wait. They're angry at being told no. That adult is talking to that child over there, not me. So that child must be more important than I am. They must be more worthy than I am. I must be worth. We're into some very big, difficult feelings for these young people that yeah. potentially they don't know how to deal with it. So what's in the toolbox of that child based on those experiences and those feelings? Well, all they've got in that toolbox, the tool that they use at home when they're not getting their own way or they need the parents' attention or something, is to throw a tantrum. So they throw it out to get what they're the connection that they're seeking, because that's the only way they know how to do it. They do that in school, though, and we're talking about aggression and violence and things along those lines. So they, well, I can't do that. So what can I do? And don't get me wrong, some will. You know, I had some 15-year-olds that threw a pretty mean tantrum. But what you've then got is a situation where what else can I do? What else is in my toolbox? And there's nothing else in it because they haven't had those experiences. They haven't learned the emotional regulation and things like that to deal with those big feelings because it's never been taught to them because technology doesn't teach those things. And so what we've now got is children who do the only thing they can do in that situation is, I can't deal with these feelings, they're too much, it's too much for me to cope with. So I'm going to put these feelings in a box over here and I'm going to disconnect and dissociate from those. And I don't want to feel those things. I don't want to feel that frustration, that anger.
Yeah.
You know, so what happens is that child then starts masking their feelings and hiding them away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, safety is in invisibility to a degree. And they just tick along in the background, trying to be unnoticed for, you know, trying to fit in and trying to cope. And we've got a lot of children that's what they end up doing is they end up masking what's actually going on. And they do all right for a while. And then when the pressures come later on and adolescence comes and mental health and all those different things, it all becomes too much for that young person. Then we look, well, this come from nowhere. it hasn't come from nowhere. It's all been building up over a long period of time. And I think the more awareness we have of that, I think we're better positioned to support those young people.
Yeah. You talk a lot about looking behind the behaviour at what actually is going on, as opposed to just looking at the behaviour. And I think that's such a key lesson for any new teachers listening, that actually the behaviour isn't telling you a story. It's what's behind the behaviour. So how do new teachers get behind it?
Well, this is a hard thing. And I think the most important thing for new teachers is that, again, one of the messages that we have is we have to be seen to be dealing with it. We have to do it there and
yes.
then. And we have to show everybody else that it's not okay and all that. And none of those things, you know, we work on a paramountcy principle where the best interests of the child is supposed to be at the forefront of everything that we do. And, you know, the best interests of that child that's distressed or struggling in that classroom is to give them some time before we start trying to challenge that behavior. But we park their needs because of how it looks to everybody else, you know. And again, there's an example I use in the book, and I use it on pretty much every training course that I do. I had a child in my class, and I was year four, and that child would come in, and under the slight, what I felt was the slightest thing, what I felt was totally disproportionate, that child would go under a table.
Mm-hmm.
And my instinct at that point in time is to get that child out from under that table. And my instinct to get him out to the table is because, well, if the other children see them under the table, they'll all think it's okay to go under the table and have 30 children under the table. Never going to happen, yeah. But that's where my brain's gone at that point in time. What if my head teacher walks in and it looks like I've got no control over my class? Yeah. What if they're shown a visit around and my behavior management looks weak? All those things are about my needs. And actually,
yes.
I need to have an open mind that tells me there is a good reason why this child is under the table. Now, I'm not going to know in this instant why they're under the table, but by not having to rush it, we'll get him out from under the table and we'll find out, and then we'll have a plan for next time. And when we actually got that child out from under the table, it turns out that child's got huge amounts of domestic violence at home. He'd been, you know, day after day, he'd been hiding under the bed because that's what he'd done. So as soon as he perceives any kind of threat, he's under the table. Now, for me, I'm in that situation going, but I only asked him to write the date. That's not as scary as a scary adult. And that makes no sense to me why he's took such a extreme response. But I'm working from a position where my thinking brain's working.
Yes.
And I'm trying to make logic of it all. That is a child who's just perceived a threat because the pen means writing. Writing means like being laughed at, looking stupid, all that kind of stuff. There's no categorization of threat in a child's brain because they're in a more primitive system. So I can't apply my logic to that child who hasn't got any logic working at that point in time. I need to look at it a different way. And if I want that child to stop going under the table, me dragging them out is going to make it worse. If I want them to stop going under the table, I've got to make them feel safe when they come in my classroom. So how I deliver those instructions and how I scaffold and how I do different things to make them feel safe, that's what will stop them from going under the table. Me getting them out and things like that won't. And that, again, is a, yes, it's more time to do the investigation work with the young people and trying to find out what the causes of things are. But it's more work in the beginning to save you lots of work down the line. Because if I do an hour that day chatting with that young person, and then I find out why they're under the table, that saves me 10 lessons of trying to fight with them to get out from under the table. And so it's, again, it's proactive rather than reactive. And this is the bit I keep trying to get across to people when we're talking about this, because I can't sacrifice the 29 to support the one.
Yeah.
But actually, which has the bigger impact? Because if we do an early intervention with a young person, you know, I've got a class of 30 children in front of me, and I'm teaching, I will only have two or three children in that class who need a level of support that is going to take up extra time for me, mm-hmm. but also that have the potential to wreck the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Some children do have the potential to wreck the lesson. So if I know which those two or three children are, and I have a plan, I can prevent that, because I'll have a class of 30 children and lots of children will wobble. They'll go off task, they'll be distracted and things like that. I might be looking over there, having my right side, and a child's gone to, you know, I call it stage one, but they're starting to wobble and things like that. And they're a bit off task. And I think, well, what do I know about that young person? And I think, well, actually, they've got the ability to self-regulate. They'll be off task for a minute. They'll have a little wobble. They'll do a bit of breathing. They might even ask to go in for a little time out or a walk or something like that. But they'll get themselves back on track and I don't need to worry about them. So I can carry on with my lesson because it's flowing really nicely. And then on my left-hand side, another child go to the same point and they're off task. I think, well, what do I know about that child? And I think, well, actually, I know that child doesn't have the ability to self-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's likely to escalate. So what I could do now is I could stop the lesson for 5 minutes and go and have a chat with them and give them a job to do or something like that, check in with them in some way. Or is it fair on the 29 to stop them for 2 or 3 minutes while I deal with that one? No, it's not fair. I've been told that I should ignore low-level behavior, so I'm going to keep going. And now I'm in a situation where they're walking around the class and they're messing with equipment and they're throwing stuff at people. And I've told them to sit down. They've answered back and I've had to call for some support. And then the support's come, but then they've given them a right gobful as well. And, you know, everybody's getting a really good show. Nobody's on task. And I look down at my watch and I've lost half an hour. So Which of those has had a bigger impact on the learning of the 29? Now, the easier option is to always just send that young person out.
Yeah.
But it doesn't solve the problem.
No.
It just moves it. And it actually, it undermines my authority in the classroom if I'm getting somebody else to come and do my behaviour management for me. And the message to the child is they don't care enough to understand me. They don't care enough to support me and things. So it just makes everything harder in the long run. And the thing that for me is most important in that scenario is that if I spot that young person wobbling and I go over a couple of times and I give them a piece of paper and say, take this to the office or let's have a chat about this or something like that, I should get to a point where that child knows they've been seen. They know I'm going to come and help them. So I might be able to say to that child, right, just give me a minute. I've seen you. Thumbs up. Yeah, I'm coming. Just give me 1 minute. And then I can find a point where I can set everybody a task and they can wait. And that's what we need to get to with our young people. And that's the big relationship thing that we're missing with a lot of our young people is they don't know that the adult is going to come and help them.
Mm.
Or they think the adult is going to come and tell them off. Or they get publicly chastised and feel humiliated and things like that. And actually what we need to do is it's all under the radar stuff that we need to be doing, you know, and not publicizing it and all those different things. But yeah, where I do feel for teachers is they're under so much pressure, and you, for this to work, you've got to feel like, okay, I can have a 5 minute pause. I can do a movement break or a sensory break or whatever it is that need to do. I can go off task a minute to do. If you're under so much pressure to deliver in a certain way and, you know, and follow a certain set of rules, there's no wriggle room there for the teacher to be able to do that, because it's all about hours. It's all about content. It's all about, you know, it's a volume of learning and all those different things. We talk about cognitive and all, load and all that kind of stuff. But if we haven't got children feeling safe in our classrooms from a learning perspective, then we haven't got the frontal cortex working in their brain. And if the frontal cortex is not working in their brain, we could do hours and hours and hours and hours and hours, and none of it's going in, none of it's going to be remembered, and you know, they're going to struggle. And this is where the catch-up narrative is nonsense. You know, more maths, more English, more maths, more English. Get rid of your forest school and whatever else you've got in it. Just do more maths and more English. Well, if you haven't took the time to switch the thinking brain on, you're pouring all of that extra maths English into a cup that's still got the lid on, and all of it ends up on the floor. Now, unless we take the time to take the lid off the cup, none of the information is going in. And it's just, it's not open-minded thinking at all. And it's treating every single child like they are, they're a computer to just pour data into. And they're not, they're human beings. And they've all got different experiences. They've all got different feelings. And we've got to make sure that those feelings essentially are safety, trust and belonging.
Yeah. You touched on something in the midst of that, which was very much about the external and about how someone would behave if they weren't being seen. And then having that fear of, oh my goodness, but my head teacher could walk in, or so they could be showing a visitor, or they could be doing this. And you touch on it in the book as well, because you talk about, you know, if your child's, you know, having a sort of paddy at home, that you'll sort of let them get on with it as such. But actually in the middle of boots, which has happened to me, and they're spread eagle and they're screaming, it's a different scenario because you've got eyes looking. And that's very much the way it is in school. There are eyes looking. So actually, I have to say, Graham, if I'm honest, I think the fact that I am long in the tooth now and have been teaching for many years means that I do feel much more confident in taking that couple of minutes, whatever, to help a child to regulate that I wouldn't have done when I started teaching, because it'd be like, oh my goodness, no, they're coming in. They might see me. I don't, you know, I need to make sure I'm on it. Yeah. I don't know where I was going with that point.
No, I think you're dead right. I think that's exactly it. I think it does come with experience. And it comes with probably, I think it's partly to do with the fact when you're first starting, you're trying to earn that authority, aren't you?
Yes.
And as you experience, you don't feel the need to keep earning it all the time. So therefore you can approach in a different way. And again, you're probably likely to have possibly moved up the scale somewhere. And so you get authority within that as well. So I don't know whether it is having to prove yourself all the time or something like that, or prove the narrative that you think that you had to have from your initial teacher training, or you get to the point where you realize your initial teacher training was rubbish. And also you work with other people as well. You know, and you look at the thing about, I think, with new staff is you watch an experienced teacher teach, and you watch what they do, and you think that you can then do that, and you think that what they're doing is what matters, and to get to the response from the children. And it's not what they're doing; it's what they've built with those children over years and years and years and years, and reputations and all of those different things. And again, the more experienced that member of staff is, the more stories there will be. People will know what that member of staff is about. The children will know themselves when they're coming into that new class. That's their, you know, and I think we feel the need, or certainly I did as a new member of staff when I first started out, I had to prove that, and I had to prove that I could be firm and I could be strong and I could be all those. And it just wasn't me at all. And like you, I think the last time I shouted was probably about 15 years ago. And I was in charge of behavior. So it's nothing to do with any of that stuff, but I think that's the message that we're often given.
Yeah, you make such a great point, because I think it is about that proving. And I wonder what newly qualified teachers' classrooms would be like, or early career teachers, whatever we call them, would be like if they didn't feel that the eyes of the world were on them, if they did feel that they could just teach and manage behaviour in a way that works for them. I wonder if they'd naturally evolve to that sort of more trauma-informed as opposed to the behaviorist, but I don't know.
But again, I think it's all about there and then, isn't it?
Yeah,
because you go in and you think, I've got to stop this behavior now.
Yes.
And that's not how it works. It's a chipping away and then being prepared for next time. You know, you gave the example of the child in boots. You know, we're in that situation. The solution might be find any way possible to get that child out of that supermarket. But if you don't then make a plan for the next time you go to Boots to prevent that happening again,
yes,
then you need your head seeing to. Because, you know, we will naturally, right, okay, so I need to keep them, you know, I need to keep them distracted. I need to have a good conversation before we go about what to expect when they get there and all those different things. You know, and what do we do with our own children in that situation? Well, we're doing things like now and next. We're doing things like, you know, we're going to give them jobs to do when we get all the things that we do with our own children to stop them from losing it in a busy supermarket are very little in difference to what we would do with our children in our classrooms. You know, we use distraction, we use plans, we use, you know, proactive strategies. That's what we need to be doing going forward. And the thing is, when we're in that situation in the supermarket of why do we need to get that child out of that scenario? Well, do we need to get them out because everybody's looking at us and tutting us and rolling their eyes at us and because we as the adult feel uncomfortable and that's why we need to get out of the supermarket? Or is the child scared? Mm. Are they perceiving lots of threat and things like that in the situation that they're in? You know, again, we've gone to primal parts of the brain. You know, I'm in a supermarket. I feel uncomfortable because I feel like I'm being judged by 20 people who are looking at me. You know, they're in a part of the brain where we're going back 300,000 years and 20 people looking at them is 20 sets of eyes, and 20 sets of eyes 300 years ago were 20 things that are going to eat you. So they're in extreme states of, you know, and in that case, let's get that child out of that supermarket. They might be overwhelmed by the colours, by the numbers, by the letters, by the busyness, the noise, all of those. Then in that case, it's best to get that child out of that supermarket. But if the reason I'm getting them out of the supermarket is because I feel uncomfortable, then I'm not working in the best interests of that child. And then we're going back to, you know, best interest principles and things like that, which is what we are, we sign up for when we work with children. So it's all of those pieces again put together, and it's, you know, that you make those decisions on the spot when things go wrong. Things will go wrong. We have to make those decisions, but then we should have a plan. And if we don't we don't have a plan, and we just keep doing the same things over and over again, we keep writing that child's name on the board and it gets worse. We keep shouting at that child, it gets worse. We keep putting that child in detention or isolation. And then they're in every day of the week. That's not proactive. That's just doing the same thing and expecting different results, which is madness. So we have to look at each child individually, which, yes, takes more time in the beginning, but it saves us loads of time down the line. And that's, you know, that child comes into that class now feeling safe, isn't off task, isn't under the test. They're now not impacting the learning of the 29.
Yeah.
Everybody's learning in that classroom now. And it's, again, I think from what I'm seeing is things like trauma-informed and the stuff I'm talking about, primary schools are much more likely to get on board for a few different reasons. But the main thing is you have your class. So you can build, it's easier to build those relationships in a primary setting with those young. If you're in a secondary setting and you've got 200 kids a week, it's much harder to do, and I totally get that. But that's where the plans are really important, and working with pastoral teams and things like that are so important, because what's happening is they're just firefighting, and the role of the pastoral team is to come and take the children away. The role of the pastoral team, when it works well, should be to inform the teachers of how to support the young people. And, you know, the example I give in the book is about firefighting. You know, the pastoral team, the people on that path, will be the school's best firefighters. They'll have the best de-escalation skills and all those different things. And, you know, when things go wrong, they are the person that's called, and they're going to come and save everybody. But if everything's already on fire, it's going to take some time to put that fire out. Now, if you constantly called out firefighters to your house because your house is on fire, what they would say to you is, we need a bit better fire prevention in this house. And it's not going to be them that does the fire prevention. It's you in the house that has to do it. And that's the early intervention stuff, is that's the opportunity for the teachers in the classrooms to do the fire prevention, so we aren't having to react with our best firefighters coming in. And it's all about, it's a whole school culture thing. It's not individual pockets. And I think what's happening in a lot of schools is they're massive buildings with lots of individual pockets of stuff going on. It's got to come from the top, and it's got to be everybody for it to be as successful as what we want it to be.
Yeah. And it comes back, in a sense, to relationships, the fact that actually if you're continually sending that child out to the pastoral team or whatever, you're not building up that relationship with that child in order to support them and to de-escalate, because they're continually going out and then they're just getting that message that...
Well, you actually, it's worse than that, because you're encouraging the behaviour.
Because yes.
What you've got, certainly with younger children, is they start that escalation, they start to struggle, and then they haven't got the development of that thinking brain, that frontal cortex and stuff. So they go into other areas of the brain and they lose control and they go to crisis, and then the pastoral staff swoop in and save them and bring mm-hmm. them out. And then they go to a nice quiet area where they're interacted with nicely and somebody makes them feel super safe and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Now, if that keeps happening, then there'll be a point at which where that child realizes they can cut the middleman out, because yep. I don't have to lose control to go to crisis to then get taken out by the past. If I misbehave, they'll send me out, and they'll send me out, and then I'll get picked up by the person that makes me feel safe and careful. And so it actually becomes a learned behavior, mm-hmm. and actually it becomes self-preservation. And makes perfect sense, because why would you stay somewhere where you're not wanted and you don't feel safe and you're not cared about when you can get to somebody where you are? And this is why children are so reluctant to leave those pastoral spaces within school, because that's what they've got there. Then you throw on top of that the social aspects of it and all those different things. It's no surprise children are repeating behaviours. It's no surprise that children are finding whatever way possible to get themselves out of classrooms. But if we can make the classrooms feel safe with people that they have yeah. relationships with, then we'll combat that. But again, much harder to do in a secondary environment than a primary environment, I think. But certainly when you go in you go and have a look at a pastoral space in school, it's the same children. Just like it's the same children in detention, it's the same children in isolation, it's the same children in pastoral. And, you know, there are varying reasons as to why that is, but there should be a route back. And I don't think there's always a route back for some of these young people.
Yeah. Now, Graham's book, everyone, is with Crown House and is called Changing Perceptions, Deciphering the Language of Behaviour. And it basically, on the back, I'll read a bit for you. It says, Changing Perceptions gives everyone working with children a better understanding of the causes of challenging behaviour and what motivates it. This book seeks to move the dial on the perception of challenging behaviour in the classroom. De-escalation is important, but it is only part of the process. If we really want to change behaviour, we have to understand it. And that's what I love about the book, Graham. It really helps me as a teacher to understand the behaviour you talk. And what you've done really well is sort of linked the science with the practical, because we talked beforehand mm-hmm. that sometimes the science can be just so highfalutin that as a teacher, I'm a bit like, oh my goodness. But actually, you've really tried to make it, well, easy for me to understand.
Well, that something I've found, the pitch is very important, and I think where I have a not necessarily unique but certainly a helpful position, what I found is that because I'm not an academic, I'm not a scientist, and I don't have a PhD and all those different things, which is a usual basis of people who are doing things like trauma-informed and stuff like that. I was the teacher, then the school leader, who needed to understand why their children were struggling so much. Mm. And so It was actually a lady called Lisa Wisher that sent me down the rabbit hole, did some training with us and sort of put me on to the likes of Bruce Perry and things along those lines. And I've gone down that rabbit hole and I've never got out of it, and I'm still learning different things every single day. But I try and take that, and then I can communicate with educators, because I'm an educator first.
Yeah.
And I did all that stuff second. So that for me, I think, is helpful. And also being a parent of two children with additional needs really gives me another perspective as well on top of that. And one thing about the book was we talked a lot about, should I have my home experiences in the book? Because it's kind of talking to parents more than it's talking to teachers. But whenever I'm training, it's one of the things that comes up in feedback all the time, is the fact that I've got those lived experiences they find really helpful. Because what we like to do is we like to put children in boxes, don't we? You know, we like to have them in an autism box or an ADHD box or a trauma box and stuff, when the reality is you've got a combination of all sorts, and children are cocktails of all sorts of different things. And the more understanding of each of the different elements, the better the position we are to work with those really complex young people that don't fit in boxes.
Yeah.
Because the days of being able to rely on CAMs and things like that, it's got to get to a really bad point before you can even get them involved at this point in time. Yeah. And we need to get that support in early for those young people.
Yeah. I have to say that I found the personal aspects of the book really powerful, and it just added another element to the book. So listeners, all of the information about the book will be on the show notes. So just go to that and click on there to find out more and read this. It really is a fabulous book. Thank you for writing it, Graham. Now, before I let you go, I have to ask my final question I ask everyone, which is this. If you could have been taught by anyone, living or dead, or indeed fictional, someone asked me the other day, could it be fictional? Yes, it can. Who would have been your perfect teacher?
It's a great question. I mean, the first one that popped in my mind would have been Bruce Perry.
I guessed that.
You know, but I actually, I'm thinking, who would have, as a child, who would have, And I think it's Jack Black.
Ooh.
And we'll park, you know, the film School of Rock, we'll park the bit where he's not actually a teacher and all the safeguarding concerns and all those different things. But just the infectious, you know, energy and stuff that I know he's acting, but I think he'd be a brilliant teacher. Just, you know, relationships and, you know, all of those different things. That for me, I think he could, if he ever decides he doesn't want to act anymore, I think he could have a decent teaching career.
A definite addition to the Tiny Voice Talk school. Graham, thank you so much for coming on Tiny Voice Talks and talking to us about behaviour and changing those perceptions.
That's lovely to be on. Thank you very much.